Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and I got my brother, who's usually the greatest endocrinologist, but we got another amazing endocrinologist on here who we're fangirling over, Dr. Susan Davis. She's a professor and an endocrinologist down under over in Australia, and she's really one of the leading researchers in testosterone therapy in women. So we're gonna ask all of our questions, and because she's kind of like an attending to me, to where I want to learn more myself. And my brother obviously is an endocrinologist too, but could definitely learn from the experts. So thanks for coming on, Dr. Davis.
Oh, thank you for having me. And I'm not sure I'll be able to answer everything, but I'll do my best.
Well, you're a good scientist, and that's the way you should answer. So, well, I'm going to let my brother ask if you started off, because he brought up all your guidelines and all sorts of different things, and I'm going to have all sorts of questions, because I actually have some patients that wanted me to ask you some questions as well.
Well, so yeah, thanks for coming on. This is amazing. I have pulled up a 2024 article in the New England Journal of Medicine that you authored that went over sexual dysfunction in women. And I think that a little bit of baseline background on some of these terminologies would be helpful for not only the lay public, but all of us clinicians, because as I went through it, I think it's probably very confusing for a lot of people. And you talk about the new ICD-11 classifications and how they're a little bit different and it's getting more nuanced. Do you mind talking about some of those? Just, I guess, the basic definitions of, you know, what is sexual dysfunction, sexual desire, hypoactive sexual disorder, that sort of thing, for people to understand what are we even talking about before we even get into menopause and premenopausal states?
I think that's a really important thing to consider, which most people don't even bother wasting time on, but it's not a waste of time. Okay, so there are two main guiding groups that talk about sexual health. One is the International Disease Classification of Diseases, ICD, which is an internationally developed consensus on different diseases and conditions, ranging from everything from sexual function to sort of dementia and heart disease and everything. And then for sexual function, there's also the Diagnostical Statistical Manual, which comes out of the US, which again is written by psychiatrists and psychologists. It's not really a general medical classification. So over the years, sexual difficulties in women have been classified as desire difficulties, arousal difficulties, orgasm difficulties, and let's say other. Very controversially, in the last edition of the Diagnostic Statistical Manual, DSM-5, the experts who were behind that section of the manual decided to combine desire and arousal difficulties as a single item. And that got a lot of pushback from the international people. And the ICD-11, the International Classifications of Diseases, is an international consensus, and the consensus maintained the differences that desire and arousal are separate entities. They have different difficulties, have different causes and different therapies. So globally, people refer to the ICD-11, not the psychiatric manual DSM-5. So that's the first thing. And in women, the sexual difficulties are classified as difficulty with just low desire, difficulty with arousal, difficulty experiencing orgasm, and other difficulties that are not classified. And one of those might be, say, sexual self-image. And then pain disorders are considered separately. Now, I'm using the term difficulty. So lots of women, for example, have low desire. it's only considered a disorder if it bothers the woman. Just like, for example, I probably have very clear obsessive compulsive traits. It's an attribute for the things I choose to do, right. But it becomes a disorder if that obsessive compulsive behavior interferes with my life, right. If it stops me being functional. So if you apply the same to sexual difficulties, low desire is only a problem if it interferes with your circumstances. So the classic is, we know that low desire dysfunction, where it's become a problem, is much more common for women with low desire who are partnered. Because if you've got low desire and you have a partner and part of your relationship has been sexual activity, that becomes a problem. But women who are single or unpartnered, it's not a big issue unless it bothers them that they, some women say intrinsically, I would like desire and it bothers me, I don't feel like I used to, but it's less likely to be a major issue. And that's where it gets very messy, because now we've got our three major difficulties: desire, arousal, orgasm, and other, the fourth group. It's a problem if it's a dysfunction if it interferes with your life. But the interfering with your life is not due to your hormones. The interfering with your life is due to all the other stuff out around you. And yet we treat it with hormones, and yet the underlying problem may well not be your low desire. It may be all the other crap in your life.
Right.
Does that make sense? So we use testosterone to treat hyperactive sexual desire dysfunction in women, low sexual desire. It may treat the low desire, but it ain't going to fix women who have a marital problem, a partner problem.
Mm. Yeah, there's a lot to untangle. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, please help us.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I mean, and certainly, Spencer, you probably do too. I have a lot of patients, both male and female, of all different age categories, where this gets discussed. And I'll say one question I have, because obviously there's a lot of psychosocial aspect to it. And like you said, it may not even be, you know, a true problem if it's not causing that person distress. But at what point do we need to dig further into other sort of organic concerns? So for example, when I see men of whatever age, and they have a new change in their libido that's lower, that means now suddenly I have to start looking for, causes of potential hypogonadism or other problems, because that could be a sign of an underlying disorder, whether or not they worry. And sometimes they'll say, maybe, you know, not to be ageist, but sometimes they'll say, oh, we're at a point in life where that's not a worry to us. And I say, well, are you having sexual thoughts and desires in your brain? I don't care who, where, what, where you think of, but it's a biological concern that I have to, you know, make sure there's nothing else going on. So in females, obviously, it's not like the testosterone in men, and we can talk about, you know, the people out there that are checking testosterone in females to see if they have low testosterone. That's a different topic that we have to discuss. Yeah. But for example, I mean, they might have, in my world, hypothyroidism. Or something else. So other organic causes. So I guess how do you tease that out when you're talking to people, teasing out the psychosocial aspects with other organic things, even if it's not actually distressful, I suppose.
So I guess my answer to that is two things. I'm old school, and I was taught if you haven't worked out what you need to investigate or what's going on by the time you need to examine the patient, you're in deep doggy do. You need to, a lot of it's in talking to the patient.
Yeah.
So, low desire, but then the person's talking about fatigue or not sleeping. So I've seen patients who present with low desire, but in fact they're perimenopausal, and once we fix that, all their symptoms are up, their desire improved. So it's taking time, firstly, to talk to the person. Secondly, two things can coexist. So you can have women who have depression can have low desire that's nothing to do with their depression, and you can't assume it's due to their antidepressant. So two things, you always give the benefit of the doubt that things can coexist. And secondly, there's always some basic stuff you test in women. You always, thyroid disease is so common in women. So yeah. Doing a TSH, doing a ferritin for iron stores, examine the patient, you know, and just
what about for the patients out there who are talking to their doctors? Because this, you know, we really try to get this out for patients. What should they be talking to patients about if they have some of these changes in low desire?
Well, I'm talking specifically about women. I mean, in men, low libido, as you've said, can be a red flag that a man has developed low testosterone. In women, low sexual desire is not associated with a low blood testosterone level. Plenty of women with low blood testosterone levels have perfectly normal desire. So what you need to do is make sure that when you go to see your doctor, you have time for a full long appointment, not a dash in, dash out, check the blood pressure appointment, that there's time to talk. And that you, I think, don't assume everything is biological and don't assume everything is psychological. So you need to explore the whole situation and be open to perhaps your assuming it's your biology, but accept it may actually be your stress or your relationship or your concerns that you're not acknowledging. So yeah. Time with your doctor.
If all their stress and all that stuff is just fine and all of a sudden they just lack desire, what's the most common cause? Would it be going through perimenopause or menopause or what's?
So we do see a big increase in low sexual desire between late reproductive years and early perimenopause. But at that time, there's no change in testosterone. Testosterone blood levels do not change at menopause. So when we see that, you've got to look into all the symptoms that are happening. And the classic symptoms are the sleep deprivation, hot flashes, night sweats, brain fog. And what we showed in a paper very recently is most symptoms track with the hot flashes and night sweats. If you don't sleep, everything goes pear-shaped.
Sleep's a big
miserable
deal.
When I don't sleep.
Yeah, you are.
So important. Your mood. When we looked at early perimenopausal women and we divided them into women with any hot flashes and night sweats and no hot flashes and night sweats, their whole symptom profiles diverged. The women with hot flashes, and I'm not talking about severe, any hot flashes and night sweats had completely more severe symptoms in terms of mood, cognitive function, sleep, aches and pains, everything. That was so much worse, and sexual function.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty obvious. It's amazing the number of females who come to us, I think, in general, you know, with all sorts of symptoms, and it just turns out they're going through menopause, and relatively simple menopausal hormone therapy is like a game changer to them. And we've talked about that for, you know, a long time. But I guess, Spencer, should we just jump to this whole testosterone thing? Because then there's this group of, I mean, there's even a prominent, I don't know if she's prominent, but an endocrinologist and a urologist and other female doctors out there basically telling like everybody they need to not only be on menopausal hormone therapy, whether they have symptoms or not, which is not consistent with the data indications that we're familiar with, but then they're also now saying everyone has to be on testosterone.
And literally everybody gets testosterone. And I know because I have patients
and then they come up with these, I don't know, they like almost seems like they're making up data to support their notions, saying, oh, it's going to, you know, improve, I don't know, their health somehow, which that doesn't seem to be consistent with the data that I've seen and that you have published. Just so everyone knows, you were one of the authors on, this was a few years old, but the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health Clinical Practice Guideline for the use of systemic testosterone for hypoactive sexual desire disorder in women. So
And an update's coming up.
Awesome. So watch out,
there's an update coming on that.
Okay.
All right.
Very cool. Mm.
We're going to be looking out for that one.
Yeah. Fill us in on this. What's going on out there?
Yeah. What should we do? Okay.
To sit here and give you evidence that testosterone is the magic bullet for everything, I could do it because I could cherry pick the literature.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily picking out the best studies, but I could sit here and very strongly, convincingly debate to you testosterone is wonderful and every woman should be on it. But the problem with that is that would be what we call cherry picking the literature. I'd be selecting studies that are not the most robust as my evidence. But if you are really honest with yourself and with the people you're speaking to, you don't just pick out one or two studies. You look at every study that's addressed, say, let's say testosterone and bone. And you say, what do all these studies consistently tell us? And just backing off a bit first, let's say let's pull out all the studies looking at testosterone and low libido in postmenopausal women. It doesn't matter how you slice or dice it, whether you look at the little studies, the intermediate studies, the big studies, they all give the same consistent answer that the majority of postmenopausal women with low libido will improve with testosterone. Not all, the majority, 60-65%. Is the improvement dramatic? Not in all, but about 65% will improve. Every study shows this time and time and time again. Now let's go to bone. Number one, the studies are all small, except for one, which was about 100 women in each group, which wasn't a very great study, and it's misrepresented. Two, none of them have reported, does testosterone prevent fracture? They've only looked at bone density. And three, the results are really mixed and inconsistent. So you could cherry pick one or two and say, oh, here's evidence. But if you take them all together, there's no consistent evidence that testosterone will benefit bone health in postmenopausal women. And that needs to be looked at more in depth. And then you can repeat that from the largest study looking at muscle is 20 women in each group. I mean, that's not a study you would then go out and tell people there's a benefit. And all the muscle studies show no benefit, basically. So what's happening is people are cherry picking the literature, and I keep using that phrase, and using it to back up their arguments. So one of the doctors I think you alluding to used one of our studies in premenopausal women to say, oh, this is evidence that testosterone improves well-being. There were 34 women in that study. When we repeated that study with nearly 270 premenopausal women, we couldn't find the same outcome. And it was probably a chance finding.
And so that was well-being.
How do you even measure the well-being? Subjective?
Oh, you do well-being questionnaires. Okay. And we found no effect in the largest study of testosterone over placebo. And I just think people they have beliefs that they've got no evidence for, but they're so strong about their beliefs that they're telling women, we don't need the evidence. I don't need the evidence. My patients feel better.
Right.
Right.
Right. That is the case. And what I don't understand, because this happens in all sorts of realms of all of our lives and in all parts of medicine, especially endocrinology, it's somehow geared towards selling people something. But I'm not exactly sure always what these guys are trying to sell them other than just their
fame. And there's some fortunes in there, but it's a lot of fame and clicks and that type of thing.
Yeah,
it is. I have no idea. I don't know why highly intelligent people will not look at the full evidence. I mean, I do medical research and sometimes I've got a belief and we do the study and we don't find what we just thought. We've just done one and we were funded by the Heart Foundation and we thought we were going to find something and it's a null study.
Yeah.
I have to accept the data's not there. It doesn't work.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, people don't like middle of the road nuance and kind of this overall consideration.
There are a lot of people that do appreciate it.
I think the big picture, it's like that meme where you have like the one guy, one microphone. I feel like the guy with one little microphone and then the quack that's telling everyone they all need to be on testosterone and all sorts of doses. I had a patient the other day, you'll love this, who came to me because she realized that she got sort of strayed and she went to see some functional medicine doctor around my area. And for zero indications, I think she at least was perimenopausal, but they put in testosterone pellets, not even just, we'll talk about what dosing you guys have recommended, like appropriate female dosing of testosterone. She had pellets and she came to me with levels in the range that I would normally get transgender men into.
Yeah.
And she was having all sorts of symptoms. And this is not the only person. Spencer's had patients like that too. And it's these places selling. And you know what else is too bad is that apparently this place charges the procedure for like $400 for in and out instead of something, you know, like something that maybe the insurance would have covered if the testosterone was even indicated. Anyways, that's my.
I see this poor women with androgenic hair loss and. And then some women, I'm like, why are you on the testosterone? Are you having libido issues or something? And they're like, I don't know. The doctor just put it with the hormone replacement or the menopausal hormonal therapy. And I was like, do you think it helped? They're like, I don't know. I don't notice any difference. And so, and then there's some women that they start it because of, for proper reasons, and they feel benefit. So maybe we can get into that.
Going back to the well-being though, we've got this randomized placebo-controlled trial where women – they get treatment A, which could be placebo first for 4 months, and then treatment B, which could be placebo or testosterone. We don't know what they're getting first. They get each treatment for 4 months, but every woman gets both active and placebo. And I said to one of my team, who's a doctor, so it would be really interesting to look at the well-being. You know, after it's a blinded study. We don't know who's getting what. And her response was, so we're not going to see anything. They love coming to the appointments and seeing us, and we talk to them.
Mm.
And even though we're trying to keep it really cool and not sort of say, you know, encourage a placebo effect, she said the fact that they come, they're getting their blood drawn, they're doing their tests, they're all so happy to come and contribute, that their well-being's great. And I think people forget that if you go to the doctor and the doctor listens to you and the doctor spends time with you, and especially if the doctor says, and I'm going to give you a treatment that's really going to help you, the placebo effect's massive.
Yeah.
And we've got to recognize that.
Yeah.
Therapeutic talk.
Yeah, we've often talked about how, you know, the insurance companies here in the United States, they don't incentivize spending time with people, but we just do it because it's the right thing. And it's amazing how sometimes spending time just talking to them, hashing it out, it makes the world to them. So
validating their experience too, validating their concerns.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's on a huge campus. Thing.
Yes. I'm tired. I'm sick of being tired.
Yes.
You know, over just dismissing them.
Yes. And then that's a big deal. That's for all of our clinician friends out there, not just the patients. You know, people are fatigued. It may not be adrenal fatigue, but something's, you know, and maybe it is life in general, but we got to look into it and acknowledge that for people. So let's get back to the testosterone a little bit. So first of all, just to make sure everyone's clear, should we be checking testosterone levels in females to see if they have low testosterone, not checking high testosterone that we often will do, but screening for low testosterone in females, because a lot of places are doing that. And why is that?
No, the answer is no. It's so simple. It's no.
Right.
And there are two reasons. There are two key reasons. One is that, there are three reasons, actually. One is that most laboratories use immunoassays, which cannot tell very low from normal. They're completely inaccurate in the female range. Terrific for screening for high testosterone, not low. Now, let's say you go to a lab that uses a much more sophisticated assay, a measurement technique, and that's called mass spec. But let's say you go to your central lab with mass spec. There is no level of testosterone that differentiates women with one cluster of symptoms from another group of women. And we've looked at that deeply. We've also looked at it again recently. And so using sensitive precision measurement. So you can't, a low testosterone has no clinical meaning. And the third reason is that it has no clinical meaning because most of the action of testosterone is happening in the cells in your body. It's being made in the cells, acting in the cells, and what you measure in the blood is spillover. It's like somebody's put out the garbage bin, I guess. That's not garbage. But it's a spillover from what the cells have already been using. So it doesn't tell us about the... I could have the same blood testosterone level as another woman, and I could have lots of hair growth, and she could have the same blood testosterone as me and no hair growth on her body because her hair follicles don't respond in the way my body's hair follicles respond. So my cells might be more super sensitive. So a blood level doesn't tell you what your cellular response is. It's sort of naive to think that.
Is there any reason to check testosterone levels to screen out high testosterone before you prescribe it? That's what one of my patients asked.
So I do. I've got three reasons for measuring testosterone. One, to investigate women who have symptoms of testosterone excess, and I want to see if they've got a hormonal testosterone excess condition. I still always, pretty well always, do a baseline testosterone in women. I guess I do it with a hormone or a measurement called sex hormone binding globulin as well. And that gives me sort of a sense of the person's profile, and it takes a bit of explaining. But I do want to see what their overall profile is and whether if I'm going to prescribe testosterone, I need to be a little bit more cautious in my prescribing. I've always said to screen out people who could have an unexpectedly high level. I rarely see that. I mean, over 20, 30 years, how often have I seen that? But I guess I stick to the script and do a baseline. And the third reason is to monitor women on the treatment to make sure they're not overusing the therapy. They're the three reasons.
Okay, so if you're going to prescribe, and we'll get into the libido and that stuff, you get a baseline just so you know where the level goes after. Is that what you're saying?
Okay, so testosterone circulates bound to a protein. And that protein...
Sex hormone binding globulin and albumin.
Well, predominantly sex hormone binding globulin, some albumin, some other proteins, so 1% or 2%. And the thing is that that protein carries sex hormones around in the bloodstream, not just testosterone, but estrogen and other hormones. If that protein, sex hormone binding globulin, is extremely, extremely low, so the normal range, depending on the lab, might be 20 to 100. And let's say I've had patients with levels down at 6. If you give a dose of testosterone, that is cleared. It's not held by the protein in the blood. It's cleared very rapidly out of the bloodstream into the cells. And if I then go and measure it to see what their levels look like if they're using too much, it looks like they're not using any at all.
Mm.
And I could then, in error, give them more.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, they're getting plenty. It's just I can't see it because it's not being retained in the blood like a person who has a high level. Then if somebody's got a very high level and you give testosterone, it looks like you're overtreating them.
Mm.
And yet they've got no hirsutism, they've got no acne, and they're not losing hair, and they tell you they feel good. And you go, oh, but your level's so high. Well, it's not so high. It's high because they've got such a high binding protein that's retaining it in the circulation, even though plenty's also getting into the cells. So it just helps me be prudent in the management. And I think most people who prescribe testosterone do not understand this.
Casey, do you do a baseline sex hormone binding globulin and total testosterone mass spec before prescribing?
We don't have routine mass spec.
Yeah, I was asking you because you also do.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, so my practice has more males or transgender males and cisgender males. But I always get a sex hormone binding globulin because I don't trust the testosterone assays across the board, no matter what. And I mean, we have, board questions that go both ways. You know, we have obesity, insulin resistance causing low sex hormone binding globulin, potentially giving us a false, false low. And then, the classic, I don't know, there's a board question I'll never forget because it does happen once in a while where a guy comes in with low libido, classic symptoms of hypogonadism, and the testosterone looks normal. So, of course, he gets dismissed, but he actually has HIV and he's on medications that made his sex hormone binding globulin go way up.
But in women.
And he enjoys real hypogonadism.
Right. But in women, you do this.
So I do, but except that I'll tell you, this is interesting. So I want to get into more of what she has to say about how to do this because... So I have a small handful of women, postmenopausal women, who have low libido. And we said, okay, well, this is where it's indicated. And I don't like using compounded medications. But as you know, where you are, you guys do have an FDA-approved testosterone gel, right? But here, and I'm going based on your guidance, is that it's about 1/10 of the dose that we would use in men for a 1% testosterone gel. So yes, in that handful, yes, I do get the sex hormone binding globulin and the baseline testosterone. But I will say, going back to what she mentioned about the just the menopausal hormone therapy, most of the females feel so much better in general. It isn't as prevalent in my world as I thought maybe it would be. So I don't have a lot of it's like a small handful of patients, but yes, the bottom line is yes.
Yeah, I don't see it that often either. I just had a patient who was interested in it. Here, it's a controlled medicine. I don't know if it is in Australia. And so I have licenses in almost every 50 state, and I have to look every state to see if I can, because they had hot flashes about 10 years ago and all sorts of vasomotor symptom type stuff. And they felt a lot better from that, but their libido is low and they're talking about testosterone. And so I was like, I'm talking to Dr. Davis tonight, so I'm going to get the best info for you. Cause I have other patients that just see their gynecologist and start it after talking to them. But
so we have our regulators called the TGA. We don't have the FDA, and the TGA, we have a TGA approved testosterone formulation for women. It's a 1% transdermal cream. Unlike the male formulations, it doesn't have permeation absorption enhancers. So you can't compare dose for dose. So our standard dose would be equivalent to about 2.5 milligrams of a male testosterone gel, 1% gel. So a lot of people are using 5 milligrams of the male gel, but 2.5 is a more appropriate starting dose. So a lot of women are getting overtreated. The other thing is that what's really interesting is that in studies that have tried to find the right dose for women, so dose finding studies, so the company producing the compound has looked at the placebo and then three or four different doses of testosterone for women. And the sweet spot's always been in the middle. And once you go above that dose, like for Procter & Gamble developed the 300 microgram testosterone patch, the 450 patch was no better than placebo. And we've seen the same with another formulation. And so it seems like you go up to a dose that really improves libido. And if you go over that dose, you actually get no more. It's not that you plateau and don't get any more benefit. The benefit is lost.
Huh.
Oh, wow.
So giving more is not necessarily better. And I see, because it's not such a hype here, we have the availability of testosterone for women. I've treated thousands of women with testosterone over the years, and some women will come back and say, it's made no difference. Lots of women will tell you it's made no difference. It is not the silver bullet.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. So what are we supposed to do here? Androgel?
Well, I think
generic testosterone gel, Spencer.
Yeah,
shill for shill for the company Androgel.
Yeah, they don't even know what company
sponsoring this episode. Come on,
is it Abbott or something? I don't know.
Well, 1%. You know, the male testosterone gels and the global recommendations, particularly with the strongly from people from America, the endos really came out strongly that you're better off to use a fraction of a male dose that's been FDA approved rather than compounded preparations where there's just no certainty that what you're getting is even absorbed, or maybe it's being hyperabsorbed and you get really high levels. It's just the compounding stuff's generally very unreliable.
You use a pump or something?
Well, so they come in pumps and they come in packets here. And so, so we have the 1% gel, like you said, 1/10 of it. And it has been a struggle of mine to feel very comfortable doing this because I don't know if I got to make sure the women feel comfortable trying to dose themselves that. And it really is, to the credit of the menopause out there, it is some sort of bias here. How is it not an approved thing for somebody?
Yeah, how do we not have a patch?
Some money. I mean,
they should have a patch.
Crazy to me. Well, they did. There was a patch approved once upon a time in Europe, right?
In 2004, Procter & Gamble got an expedited review with the FDA, and it was more than unanimous that there was evidence of benefit, but the panel felt uncomfortable that there was insufficient evidence of safety for both insulin resistance and lipids. And unfortunately, I think they went prematurely before they had sufficient data. And it's a bit like keep friends close and your enemies closer. The company was talking to all the people that kept saying, wow, this is great. We need this for women. And not speaking to the people who might say, oh, I'm not so sure about this. What about heart disease? What about this? What about that? And I think if they'd been a little bit more prepared for concerns being raised, and also if they'd waited till they got a bit more data in which they have ultimately got in, they would have got across the line. And then since that time, different companies have gone and spoken with the FDA. I mean, I've been to the FDA with one company, and this whole review is in the urology section, and you've got people who have no understanding of female sexual function and no understanding of testosterone physiology in women. And it just got stonewalled. And I think the cost of developing a product and getting in front of the FDA is so substantial. Mm-hmm. Unless a company really feels that they've got a possibility of a door opening, they just don't go. Companies are financial organizations. They just don't go to purposefully to go and bang their head against a brick wall. I suspect there is possibly an opening now. And I think the time is now for companies who've got products for women to be banging on the FDA door. And I think that we do have the product available in Australia has just been approved in the UK. So I'm not promoting that product. I'm saying anybody with a testosterone formulation appropriate for women.
Yeah, that would make our lives a lot easier.
On the door.
Yeah, it would be nice to have a reliable, trustworthy, easy, FDA approved. Boom, go get it. I had one of my most recent patients. They gave us the insurance company. They wouldn't cover it because it was a female. And it's relatively cheap generic gel. And I was really mad. I was like, this is why people are mad about this bias that we have.
I mean, there is.
That's this built-in bias. I couldn't believe it. I was so mad. And then we're trying different formulations. I don't know.
I guess my stand on it is irrefutably, there's evidence of benefit for postmenopausal women with low libido. We lack evidence that it will improve anything else. Despite what people want to believe, okay, it's not there. However, women with low libido who want to do something about it are being forced to use off-label products or compounded therapies in the US. And I believe that the FDA is not protecting these women by not even inviting companies with potential products to come before them. And then you do your post-marketing surveillance. But when, I mean, the largest study I did was 800 women across Europe, North America, and Australia, and we showed no evidence of harm.
Like so, lipids and all the blood pressure, all that stuff.
Nothing. Insulin resistance, glucose, lipids, you name it, mammographic density,
endometriosis. Appropriate density. Dosing, though.
A female appropriate dosing. Appropriate yeah, dose.
That's the problem we run into, too. we talked about before. Yeah.
But women are using inappropriate doses either because the inability to accurately measure a male product out, or because they're using compounded therapies, or because they, or because it's the Wild West. And I think women have the right to have access to a product
Absolutely.
That's suitable for them.
Yeah.
Okay, so baseline, you get a total testosterone mass spec with sex hormone binding globulin, and someone comes in, they're all their menopausal hormonal therapy is already taken care of with progesterone, estrogen, but they have libido issues. So you get the baseline. You start them on what dose do you start them on?
We start, now, don't forget.
I know the equivalents are different.
Australian product.
Australian
it's
product.
5 milligram daily. So it's got no absorption enhancers. So it's equivalent to about 2.5 milligrams of 1% males.
1% male. Okay. And then you do check, there's sex hormone binding globulin and total testosterone mass spec after how long that they've been on.
Well, I don't do mass spec. I'm looking for high levels.
Okay. So you don't need
I'm not treating, I'm not treating them because they've got low testosterone.
Got it.
And the only reason I'm doing a blood level is to make sure that they're not miscalculating how much they're putting on. And nobody wrote this rule book. I had to work it out what worked for me.
You wrote it out.
Well, there's no, it's years of just what works. And I decided I would do, by 3 weeks, people have reached a steady state. And that at about 3 to 4 weeks, I always get patients to do a blood level.
Okay.
Just to make sure that I can pick up if they're using inadvertently too much before they develop adverse effects. So I can get on the phone and say, hey, how much are you applying? Where are you applying it? Have a conversation. And then I always review the patients at 12 weeks. What we see in the studies, women start to experience an improvement at about 4 weeks. I don't bring them back at 4 or 6 weeks because I used to bring patients back at 6 weeks and they'd say, oh, I don't really know. My husband's been overseas for work for 3 weeks. And, or my cat died, or we went away for 2 weeks, so I didn't start it till I got back. And so they really haven't had time to see if we've got an improvement or not. And I found that the sweet spot again for me is about 12 weeks, because then they've got time to see whether there's been a benefit. If there's any uncertainty, I will give them another 3 months therapy. And if there's no benefit by 6 months, we stop.
And when do you retest their level? So what time, 4 weeks you said?
About 3 to 4 weeks.
Do you do both the sex hormone binding globulin and the total testosterone, or just the total?
Just routinely.
Okay. And at what level are you like, oh gosh, this is too much, or?
So we've also done pharmacokinetic studies. That means for people who don't understand, that means we get a whole lot of women and we give them a set dose at 8 o'clock in the morning. We draw blood for 24 hours and then they come back 3 weeks later after using it and we do the same thing again. And what you see is that the profiles do vary between individual women. So there's no perfect time to draw blood to check the level. And the blood level will depend on even skin temperature. So if you put the cream on your inner thigh, you'll get a completely different blood level profile than if you put it on your outer thigh, because when you're in bed at night and your legs are together, you absorb more. The blood level really is quite random. The only thing, as I say, don't put your cream on and then get your blood drawn. So pretty well, you're not going to run into any trouble if the total testosterone is not more than 50% above the upper limit for a premenopausal woman. So if your lab, you're in nanograms per deciliter, if your lab says blood testosterone levels, the upper limit for a premenopausal woman is 60 nanograms per deciliter.
That's about right.
Yeah.
If it's, you wouldn't want it more than 90.
Okay, cool.
And of course, it's about the woman. A woman could come in with a level of 40 nanograms per deciliter and say, my skin's really oily and I'm getting acne. That means she's just sensitive, and then you've got to modulate the dose. Yet I can see women with much higher levels who have no side effects. So everybody's different.
And the sex hormone binding globulin, I mean, are you calculating a free, or are you just looking at the actual?
Free testosterone is meaningless. I don't, it's
garbage.
It's
okay.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just using it to kind of guide the.
Yeah.
Is it, well, is it a true high? Is it a true low? You know, yeah. Right.
Is it a true high? Is it a true low? I'm not using a formula.
Yeah.
Got it.
And why is free testosterone meaningless? Firstly, we've got no evidence it's the most biologically active part. But the second thing is the formulas that you use to calculate free testosterone. There are three main formulas. And if you apply the three formulas to the same testosterone and sex hormone binding globulin level, you'll get three different answers. And they were developed before we understood that SHBG has two binding sites, and they look at testosterone as though it's the only thing binding sex hormone binding globulin in the blood, where there are multiple hormones binding it. So it's a naive form. The formula's naive.
Sheesh. Yeah. All right. I'm learning a lot because I don't do this a lot.
I know. I mean, this is great for endocrinology. So okay. So that kind of takes care of the perimenopausal, postmenopausal females where we had like the most questions and all that stuff. Now I read in your global position statement that talks about endorsing testosterone therapy for postmenopausal women, but. And I don't even know what this stands for, but the ISSWSHPOC includes women in their late reproductive years. There's something else. There's some consideration out there for premenopausal females. But in your New England Journal of Medicine article, you get into some of the other approved medications that have very modest benefits that are not testosterone. So I feel like we should at least touch on premenopausal females who have addressed, you know, any other organic issues, the psychosocial aspects of it that are very important and complicated, we all know. But the low, you know, sexual desire and disorder in premenopausal females. Am I correct that there's something in that position statement? Like I'll read what it says because it's a little confusing to me. It says, where did it go? Something about hypoactive sexual desire disorder in premenopausal women.
Do you treat premenopausal women with testosterone?
Yeah, basically. There's something of words. It doesn't totally rule it out, I guess, is what I'm trying to get at. It's confusing.
So testosterone blood levels decline by about 25% between the ages of 18 and 40. And then they decline another 25% between the ages of 40 and about 60. And then levels start to increase. So by the time women are in their 70s, they have similar blood testosterone level to women in their 20s.
What's that from?
Don't know. Don't understand it.
Interesting.
So blood testosterone levels do not change across menopause. And I'm not talking about women having their ovaries removed. I'm talking about natural menopause. They change with age. And so if a woman, as far as I'm concerned, I am prepared to treat women in their late reproductive years with testosterone if they've got low libido with distress. We've done two studies of women aged 35 to 45 with low libido causing them distress with regular menstrual cycles, and they're placebo-controlled trials, and we have shown subtle benefits of testosterone for those women. And we're just about to start a much larger study in premenopausal women. So we're going to be recruiting women aged 35 to 50 who are premenopausal and seeing if testosterone benefits their sexual function. I would not be treating a 25-year-old with testosterone, because if a 25-year-old's got regular menstrual cycles, they're making plenty of testosterone. But we do know that by the time women are 35 plus, their ovarian function's waning, that they're highly likely to, you know, be on that downward slope of testosterone. And obviously you've got to look at women with PCOS, et cetera. They're a different group.
Yeah.
But I don't rule out treating women in their late reproductive years with testosterone.
Okay.
Or perimenopausal women.
Yeah. And then I guess maybe just a couple of your thoughts on the other medications we do have for all females. The bremelanotide.
Belisi. Oh yeah, we're not allowed to say brand. We can say it. It's a podcast. Well, that's the one that I.
Right. They're not paying for it.
Yeah. I prescribe Belisi for my premenopausal women with low libidos.
We don't have any of those in Australia. Flibanserin never made it here.
Yeah,
I've prescribed buspirinone occasionally, and it's been beneficial for some.
Mm.
But because we've got testosterone, it's our go-to.
Okay.
You're the testosterone so even
in the even in the premenopausal females, if you had access to those medications, the flibanserin, that I feel like is relatively pushed or it's marketed here. I don't know if a lot of people are prescribing it. I haven't prescribed it because
I'm not impressed with the data.
It was very modest. It was like it increased the amount of satisfying sexual encounters by like a half per month, but with a lot of side effects. But the bremelanotide that Spencer's talking about, which is the melanocortin medication, which actually gets a little bit more into our world of obesity medicine, that has a little bit more interest to me. So just wondered if that would be, if you had that, how would you compare that in your opinion? Yeah. In the premenopausal females?
I can't comment because I think you'd have to do a head-to-head study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the other thing is that you've just pointed out a really major issue, which was a real challenge for us designing the current premenopausal study. You're talking about satisfactory sexual events.
I think that's what
it was.
This was
a construct that was developed by Procter & Gamble with the FDA. I don't recall who drove it with. It was P&G or the FDA. Satisfactory sexual events is sort of crap. I mean, what is that?
Is that what it is? Has to be a guy thing. Some guy made this up.
And it's like, firstly, there is a limit. Because what you've got is, I mean, we did a study of how frequently women are having sexual activity if they're partnered or not, if they're pre or postmenopausal and happy or not happy with their sex life. And the number of sexual events in a relationship is sort of pre-established. So if you've got you could have a fantastic improvement in desire, but your frequency of sexual activity may not change because that's when you've got time with your partner. It's only on weekends or, you know, the day that your partner doesn't get up and go early to gym, that you actually have an opportunity to have sex.
Yeah.
And so what we were if you go to your doctor with low libido and you don't have a partner and you're not sexually active, but you want to have libido so you can be sexually active, how do you register satisfactory sexual events?
Right.
It's like it excludes a whole lot of people. And so in designing this study, we've said, well, okay, testosterone's approved for women in Australia for low desire that bothers women. If I look at all the Procter & Gamble studies that I was involved in, women were recruited because of low desire. And when we looked at the women recruited, they all had sexually related distress, even though it wasn't inclusion criteria, because the fact that you would want to take a drug for low libido means it bothers you. So our inclusion criteria will just be low libido and you wanting to do something about it.
Right.
And our outcome will be desire, because that's what we're trying to improve. We're not going to, some women just want to experience desire to feel whole. They don't even care about the sex.
Yeah.
And you might have improved desire, which is what the drug's done, but you still might be anorgasmic, but you've enjoyed having that intimate experience. So this whole satisfactory sexual events that all the data is based on is a real nonsense to me. Yeah. That's my belief. I might be wrong.
I'm sure it's true. And I'm sure it's some, I know what's going on. It's some guy, that, you know, it's like the guy who started the Victoria's Secret, right? Isn't there's a song about it?
I don't know.
That's guy, no, he's like some guy in Ohio, the guy that made Victoria's Secret, guy in Ohio.
Okay.
Oh, I did have a patient earlier today talk about, like, because I was asking about libido, because we're talking about menopausal hormonal therapy, and I'm like, eh, she's like, I don't have a libido, but I don't really care. And I was like,
that's okay.
I was like, okay. She's like, you can take it or leave it. She's like, yeah, I don't really care about that. I was like, all right. Okay, I'm glad, you know, glad I asked so I understood, but it's true.
But again, what will determine a satisfactory event is not your sexual desire.
Right.
There's so many other factors. Yeah. And so when the whole testosterone prescribing thing gets based on satisfactory sexual events, when there are so many other determinants of that, it's such an artificial construct.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
You're making me more mad about this now.
Yeah, that's frustrating. What other questions? I mean, this has been great. I know I learned a lot because I do have some women. I'm like, okay, I'm going to see if I can get my license in the certain states so I can make sure I can take care of them completely. So I know I have a good plan of how to do that. But
very, very helpful to help my comfort level. And hopefully all of our listeners, female listeners, who this is confusing with all the social media stuff out there. So I think this is great.
Yeah,
so
thanks for bringing it down.
I guess some bottom line points. I mean, testosterone therapy potentially indicated for low sexual desire, but really has no benefits beyond in some sort of global manner that's being marketed out there.
There is no current evidence that you would prescribe testosterone for the treatment or prevention of anything except low libido. Now, having said that, I'm not saying that we may not find a benefit in due course, but the studies are too small and too inadequate. And then someone said, well, why does that matter if a woman thinks that there's a benefit? Well, for osteopenia, for example, low bone density, you wouldn't want to put all your money on testosterone and have a woman then miss out on proper ways of building her bone.
Right, which we have great therapy for that.
Yeah. The studies of muscle have only shown a benefit when testosterone blood levels get up to 4 to 5 to 6-fold times what's normal for a premenopausal woman. And in the comments made at the FDA panel that, women over the age of 65 in one study didn't need their walking sticks to do their 6-minute walk test, there are two issues with that. One, that study gave testosterone that got blood levels up to like 160 nanograms per deciliter, which is not normal for a woman.
Yeah.
And two, no other outcome was meaningful, and this was a post hoc unadjusted analysis, which means they were looking to find something. They were basically beating the data until it could confess and find some positive outcome.
Yeah.
But no other outcome showed a benefit.
Yeah.
And I always hear about anxiety, all sorts of other things where the menopausal.
There's no evidence.
Yeah.
There is no evidence. There is a big study going on in the UK to try and see if there is a global effect on well-being, and the results will be really interesting.
Very
but
good.
Right now, it's not the silver bullet.
Yeah.
Well, I've learned a lot. Anybody listening, friends, family who are confused about this topic, Dr. Davis is literally you know, the guru on this, the top researcher in this realm. She definitely taught us a lot during this.
Yeah, this is awesome.
We appreciate you so much. Your Instagram, please follow her on Instagram. Like, I, every time I watch, I'm like, oh, I'm going to learn now because it's just not in my realm. So,
and for the clinicians out there, like I said, the 2024 New England Journal of Medicine article, and then apparently a soon to be updated International Society for Study of Women's Sexual Health Clinical Practice Guideline for the use of testosterone. So keep on the lookout for that.
Yeah. All of her papers. Follow everything if you're interested in this topic. Thanks so much for coming on, Dr. Davis.
Thank you.
That's my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Yes. Here is our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
It's a disclaimer.